On this week's edition of New York Now, the legislature continues its probe into the state's handling of nursing homes during COVID-19. Senate Ranker on Aging, Sue Serena, joins me to discuss.
We should use the subpoena power, and the legislature dropped the ball with that.
Lawmakers also held hearings on how the crisis impacted the state's hospitals and the primary elections in June. Karen DeWitt is with me in studio to discuss. Governor Cuomo gives schools the green light to reopen, but that's easier said than done. Andy Pallotta from New York State United Teachers joins me to explain. And the debate over removing monuments to controversial historical figures arrives in New York's Capitol. I'm Dan Clark, and this is New York Now.
Today, the Senate majority will pass a legislation
prohibiting it, and we will take them to court challenging it.
Yet another stand for New York and sending a message to the nation.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Dan Clark. Lawmakers continued a series of hearings this week on the state's handling of COVID-19. You'll remember that last week they heard about nursing homes. This week they held another hearing on nursing homes. We'll get to that in just a little bit. But they also held hearings on how hospitals were affected and how the pandemic caused problems for this year's primary elections in June. I want to focus here first on the elections hearing, because unless the state fixes what went wrong in June, we could be looking at a repeat situation in November. And there were some huge issues during the primary, largely in New York City. Here's Senate Elections Chair Zellner Myrie.
Many people took advantage of voting early, many people voted in person, and many people took advantage of voting by absentee. But too many New Yorkers saw their democracy fail them during this pandemic. Thousands of absentee ballots were discarded. Many people had bad experiences at their polling sites. And for them, their democracy stopped in this pandemic.
Karen DeWitt covered that hearing this week. She's with me now in studio now to talk about that and much, much more. Karen, thanks for being here.
Sure. Covered the hearings remotely, of course, from our homes and our computers.
I know, and watching them for 5, 6, 12, 24 hours, however long they last that day.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, they have been very long.
So what were your takeaways from the elections hearing? It sounded like to me, and I don't mean to step on your toes, but it sounded like to me that the elections officials that testified basically said, our system wasn't set up for a bunch of paper ballots to come in.
Yeah, exactly. Because in the past, 8 to 10% were absentee ballots, and in the primaries, 50 to 60%.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and they just don't have the staff. They don't have the preparation. They have to rely on the Postal Service, which some of the commissioners brought up. That's very uncertain with what's going on with President Trump's appointee trying to slow down the mail. I'd also point out Governor Cuomo has not signed an executive order yet that would allow New Yorkers to use absentee ballots. Because of COVID in November. He's expected to, but that hasn't happened. So they can't even start preparing for that until the governor issues an executive order. Because right now you have to be either out of the two, you have two excuses to be use an absentee ballot. And I think it's out of the county you live in, or if you're physically too ill to go to the ballot.
And I think the legislature passed a bill that would basically mirror that executive order if it happened, but I don't think it's gone to the governor's desk.
Well, that's
yet.
Right. There's a bunch of bills that we probably can't even get into right now because it would take too long. They're trying to tweak all these election things, but the governor hasn't yet signed them or vetoed them.
Yeah, the thing I found most interesting about the hearing was that a lot of this is just out of their control. As you said, like the U.S. Postal Service, for example, right now absentee voters can request an absentee ballot up to 7 days before the election. And you have to think, as somebody who is sending in that application by paper, it's going to take a few days to get to the Board of Elections. And then they're going to look it over, approve your application, and then it's going to take a few days to get back. So all of that depends on the Postal Service getting it to them and then back to you in time for you to send it out by Election Day, which it just sounds confusing to me just thinking about it.
And also, it seems like some races are not going to be decided. We're not going to know Election Night. I think we'll probably know the presidential results because New York is such a blue state. But you got state Senate races, assembly races, congressional races that are probably going to be tight. And as we saw in the primary, it could be weeks before they count all those ballots or even months. So it's going to be a while before we know, but it just seems like are going to have to do mail-in voting. They're not going to be able to run a regular election in November.
What about the nursing homes hearing? I watched some of it this week. This was the second nursing home hearing. The first one was last week. What were your takeaways?
I watched a lot of it, but certainly not all of it.
Yeah.
But the takeaway was that the nursing homes were just not prepared for a pandemic.
I mean, who was?
Yeah. No, I know. But there are pandemic plans that exist that have sat on the shelf for a really long time. And, you know, maybe they should have dusted them off every few years and looked at them. But they just were not prepared for the influx of patients. In some cases, it seemed like they didn't want to test the residents for COVID. Perhaps they didn't want those numbers of death to count against them. And the relatives that testified, really some compelling and very upsetting stories of how they couldn't talk to their relatives. They weren't told that there was COVID in the nursing home. One man said he would have taken his mother out had he known, but the nursing home didn't tell him. And when they advocated for tests for their relatives, who, you know, they were told their relatives had a fever, a cough, they were told, oh no, they don't need a test, we're going to treat them anyway, and, you know, just let it go. And then you don't have accurate numbers of how many people did get the disease and how many people died there. And that's kind of important information for if there's a second wave, or God forbid, in a couple of years, we have another pandemic. I mean, just because we had one, you hadn't had one for 100 years, doesn't mean that we're going to wait another 100 years, right? Who knows?
Right. I couldn't imagine being one of those family members.
Yeah.
Looking really ahead to Monday, the governor is speaking at the Democratic National Convention,
right.
Presumably digitally. I don't think he's going to fly out to Wisconsin.
I imagine, yeah, from his ceremonial office where he does everything in the Capitol now.
Right. He didn't get a lot of attention in 2016 when he spoke. What do you think is going to happen this year?
I was there. I was covering the convention. I went down to the hall to hear him speak. It was a semi-primetime slot. It was like 7 or 8 o'clock. And so he was on TV. But in the hall, everybody was talking. It was one of those times of the evening, everybody's talking among themselves, getting ready for the big speeches. And, you know, he gave a speech about his father, Mario Cuomo, and, you know, his philosophy of governing. And nobody listened or paid any attention. But I'll tell you, I think it's going to be a lot different Monday night. He's a national figure now. And it is going to renew, you know, questions or speculation about him becoming president or running for president. Even though he said, we got to point out, he said many, many times, I don't want to be president. I'm happy being governor. But if he does a good job, it's going to feel speculation again.
Oh, for sure. And we will be watching. Karen DeWitt, thanks as always for being here.
Sure thing.
Moving on now to reopening schools this year. Students will head back to class in the next few weeks, and whether that means they'll be in the classroom or learning online, that's going to depend on the district. Some teachers have said they don't feel safe going back to school, but they're also worried about the quality of remote learning. That's a huge challenge that districts will have to grapple within the next few weeks, and teachers will be a big part of that conversation. I spoke with Andy Pallotta, the president of NYSA, the state's teachers union. Andy Pallotta from NYSA, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Anytime. So we know that the governor has now given schools the green light to open in a few weeks. And I guess the question on everyone's mind is, are schools ready to safely reopen for students, faculty, and staff?
It's a great question because that's all we've been talking about right now. It's all about reopening. Are they safe? Will they be healthy? So we've come to a place now where we say the models that have been put forward are a hybrid model, a in-person model, or a totally remote model. And it is up to districts throughout the state. We have about 750 districts around the state. They will be discussing this. We've heard a lot of feedback from our own folks saying they're very nervous about going back. The way things are right now, they just don't know. Maybe a phase-in would be good. So they have an option at this time. They can see what they would like to do. And given that option, it's very good.
Has the state, there are guidelines from the state education department and from the governor's task force on reopening. Has the state done enough right now to safely reopen schools, or could the state be doing more to clarify for educators and administrators what actually needs to be done before we start, or are we on a good track to get things started in the next few weeks?
We still need a lot of clarification, especially on testing and tracing in the school districts. But one of the main concerns we have right now is that 127 school districts did not even respond to the need to present to the state a health and safety plan to come back to school. So if you have 127 that didn't even bother to respond, I have no confidence in what's coming from that district. And also there were 50 that were incomplete. So you're talking about close to 200 districts that are definitely in no shape way of form able to say, we're ready to come back.
I imagine this has to be such a difficult decision for teachers because on one hand, you had remote learning go into effect in the spring, and at the time, teachers said, and I think rightly so, that remote learning just, you know, it's not as good as in-person learning. But at the same time, now coming into the fall, now we have teachers, rightly so again, I think, saying, we don't know if we're going to be safe going back. So how do you balance those two things as educators, making sure that students get the most education, but that you're protecting people from a disease that has killed thousands here in the state?
Right. So we have definitely heard their concerns. They want to go back. They do want to be with their children, their students. That's their goal. But they also want to be safe, and they want the children to be safe. So you try and balance this out. We've come up with, at least on closing a school, that if there were a case, that the school would be closed for 14 days. That's what we're advocating for. But if the students, the parents, the educators are not comfortable going back, then they have that option now too, that they can start in a remote way. Everyone writes to me, they call me, they say, Andy, we would rather be in the classroom, but we would rather err on the side of caution. So this is crucial for us, that erring on the side of caution would be the way we would want to go.
So we're talking about things that people can choose, like going back to school, teaching remotely, things like that. Let's talk about something that you don't have any control over right now, and that's funding. And I think on any year, pandemic or not, education funding is a major issue and something that is always divisive and something that schools seem to need more of. But this year you have all of these extra requirements, and I feel like a lot of it is falling on the backs of teachers. How do you take the funding levels you have now and apply it to what you have to do? I guess, can schools do this with the money that they have?
Right, they definitely need the funding. We've been fighting for the federal funding going on months now. But we believe without that funding, how can you do what you need to do for the students throughout the state? Whether it's providing them with a laptop, a Chromebook, internet access, all of these things that need to be done. The social distancing, providing masks, because we're advocating that each child would have a mask on during instruction. I think that keeps us even safer. So the teacher would have a mask on. There would be social distancing. Some schools have opted for barriers also. These are the kind of things that we need done. HVAC systems, which need to be inspected. NYSET is even working with CSEA to do workshops on taking a look at your HVAC system. So this is what we're at right now, what we're trying to accomplish in the next couple of weeks.
All right, Andy Pallotta from NYSET. Always great to talk to you. Thanks for being here this week.
Seeing you too. Thank you.
We'll have more on schools in the next few weeks as the school year starts. We told you earlier in the show about this week's hearing on the state's handling of nursing homes during COVID-19. It was the second hearing on that topic this month. The state health commissioner did not return this week to testify, and many were not so happy about that. Lawmakers say they still have plenty of questions for the governor's office about nursing homes. One of those lawmakers is Senator Sue Serino. She's the top-ranking Republican on the Senate Aging Committee. We spoke earlier this week. Senator Serino, thanks so much for being here on New York Now this week.
Thank you, Dan, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, anytime. So this week we had the second hearing on the state's handling of nursing homes. Last week we had the first hearing. We've heard a lot of testimony. This week we were talking before and you said 13 hours of testimony, several hours the week before. Have we learned anything that you think could be used, that could have been used to help prevent the 6,000 plus deaths that happened that were linked to nursing homes during the COVID-19 crisis?
Well, you know, we still didn't get a lot of the answers that we were looking for. Unfortunately, the health commissioner in the governor's office was only there. They were there last week and not this week. And when we asked questions, you know, because we want to know, how were these decisions made? A simple question, you know, so we can know what went wrong and moving forward, how we could correct it. And we owe that to the parents, siblings, loved ones of all these people that died in the facilities.
I'm surprised, honestly, that the health commissioner didn't show up for the second hearing. I don't know whether he was invited or not. I don't really know what was behind that. But if you had the opportunity to go for a second round of questioning, What would you ask him? What would you want to know? I mean, as you said, he was only there for 2 hours last week, during last week's hearing. So I have to assume there were some questions that didn't get posed to him that you think should have.
Well, even some of the questions that I asked him, Dan, I said, who, you know, made these decisions, you know, out of your group? And he said, well, I have 1,500 people. And, you know, he was being very evasive. And even if the governor would have said, or the health commissioner, listen, we made some mistakes. Let's move forward. Let's work together to make things better. I had come up with some ideas, like with the specialty care centers. I even talked to the Department of Health about it. We had a conversation. They never, ever answered me with regard to, like, my ideas that we would have, you know, just specific places. They could be regional, and they would be specifically for COVID patients. They would get more funding, have just dedicated work staff. Not an answer at all, Dan. That's terrible.
You know, something that surprised me about the hearings was that at the start of it, I think it was Senator Tom O'Meara that mentioned that the Democrats, who control both houses of the legislature, didn't give Republicans the chance to call witnesses or assist in any subpoena power. And I'm wondering, if you were in the majority, is there anything that you would want to subpoena, or any witnesses that you were particularly interested in hearing from that didn't show up? In other words, if you had the power, how would you use it?
We should use the subpoena power, and the legislature dropped the ball with that. They should have done that. So we're, you know, when somebody is subpoenaed, there are very specific questions. Like, you can't just say there's 1,500 people, right? They want to know who made those decisions. Why were those decisions made? And those are the questions and answers that we did not receive through the first testimony when the health commissioner and the governor, so the governor's office was there.
So looking forward, I know that the hearing was just this week. We had the hearing last week. Do you think there's anything the legislature could do moving forward if we do have another spike in cases, or, you know, God forbid we have another disease that spreads like this in the state? Is there anything the legislature could do, in your opinion, to prevent something like this from happening again, looking specifically at nursing homes, of course?
Yeah, we need to have specialty centers, the specialty care centers. And I think a couple of people had, you know, people that were testifying had mentioned that too, that if we had those specialty centers, they would be an answer, because the people would be quarantined in that area along with the staff. You know, the staff would just work specifically for the COVID-related patients. We also know that we need PPE. You know, the nursing homes were like an afterthought. They didn't get the proper PPE that they needed. And we have to invest in staff also, besides the PPE. We had ideas even for grants to hire staff for people that had lost their jobs and might have worked in hospitality. Even getting a couple people in a nursing home to answer the phone, to talk to people about their loved ones. Over and over, we've heard time and again, no communication. People just didn't know what was happening with their loved ones. Can you imagine? I mean, I think of me with my mom. I would be devastated.
Me too. And I'm really interested to see, again, it's early, but I'm really interested to see what comes out of the hearings, whether it's legislation, whether it's a deeper probe. I just have no idea. So we'll be watching. Senator Susarino, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks.
Republicans announced later in the week that they would hold their own roundtable on the state's handling of nursing homes next week. Now for a story out of Albany about something that's happening all over the country. Since the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis, there's been a lot of discussion about removing monuments that depict people who either supported slavery or were involved in the Confederacy. In Albany, that conversation is happening about the statue of Philip Schuyler, who you might know if you're a fan of the musical Hamilton. But what you probably didn't know about Schuyler is that he was one of the most prominent slave owners in the Northeast, with deep roots in the capital city. And now Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan says the city will remove the statue from in front of City Hall. Nicole Van Slyke has the story.
Albany is quiet today. The marches and the protests following the killing of George Floyd have decelerated for now.
But here in Albany, one of the city's controversial monuments and a topic of debate, the Schuyler statue, still stands in front of the City Hall. But that won't be the case for much longer. The removal of the Schuyler statue is a microcosm for what is happening around the country. The last couple of years, we have seen a rise in action and debates that are asking that we, as a nation, reconsider what and whom is acceptable to be publicly glorified regarding our nation's past. It is a conversation that this country is still trying to figure out how to navigate.
And one that finally we are not shying away from.
Well, Philip Schuyler was upstate New York's greatest patriot. He was one of the founding fathers of the nation. His sacrifice and his brilliance enabled us to win the Battle of Saratoga, which of course was the turning point in the Revolution and, you know, enabled our country to basically be created.
I think Philip Schuyler made some contributions, great contributions to the city and to the state of New York, and I respect that. However, I see Philip Schuyler as a white supremacist who enslaved a large number of people, and this meant that he exploited their labor. He was able to profit from that. And it also says to me that he devalued black lives, because when you enslave, you treat people as animals.
I think it's a rash and ill-informed reaction. And I think it's something that politicians are doing in the heat of the moment. And I think it's something that over time we'll deeply regret if in fact they go through with removing the statue.
If we glorify this man by putting a statue in front of our city hall, that we are still devaluing the lives of black people.
Taking down the statue is not going to erase his name from upstate New York. There are museums, parks, historic homes, even villages dedicated to the remembrance of Philip Schuyler, the American Revolutionary War general and United States senator. Why is it so important to some to leave the statue where it is in the capital of New York?
Well, Philip Schuyler was a son of Albany. Albany was his home. And this is Albany's most prominent memorial to its most prominent patriot. So I think it's fitting that we honor him, that we remember him, and that statue should stay just where it is.
You know, you can glorify him all you want to in some private location, but this, I pay taxes. This says, to me that if we continue to leave it there, that my government supports white supremacy and systemic racism that we're fighting against right now.
It is a very difficult discussion that requires taking a long, hard look at our national history and trying to come to terms with what was. When we engage these dialogues, we start to pry apart a story of a nation. And the issue there is that our story was built on the oppression of African Americans. So if we want to move forward, we need to grapple with how to tell the whole story.
When you tell the full story, you don't exclude, but you include. And I think looking at examples of public art that were of their time, so they are limited, but they continue to inspire, are good ways for societies or cities to say, what really do we want to show in our community? And public art has a very specific role in which it represents the values of a community. Sometimes those values change, they often do, and sometimes individuals don't feel included in what that piece of public art represents.
Officials who run the Schuyler Mansion, Philip Schuyler's centuries-old residence in Albany, declined to comment on how they are going to move forward with educating the community about Philip Schuyler and the debate around the statue. We did visit another one of the city's landmarks and the home of the Albany County Historic Association, the Tenbrook Mansion. The Tenbrook Mansion was also established by a wealthy politician family that fought in the Revolution and where at least 12 enslaved people worked at one time. We talked to the executive director there about how they hope to build an education for the community.
The mission of the Albany County Historical Association is to preserve, present, and interpret the rich and diverse culture of Albany County. By telling the full picture, children can be inspired to see that all of us work to build the United States, all of us are participants in our society, and all of us can contribute. So a museum, by telling the full story, doesn't discourage, it doesn't exclude, but it inspires and includes, and that's what we seek to do.
As we move forward, we hope to learn, ask questions, and continue the conversation around where our standards lie as a city and as a state and as a country.
I think the standard is pretty clear. Confederate statues to Confederate leaders, those are people that took up arms against the United States. Philip Schuyler didn't take up arms against America. He helped create America. This is someone who should be honored, not tore down.
I think we need to learn, and we need to look again at history, but it's not realistic to think that you can change everything, and I know that. But I want people to understand what it represents to me and why I want it removed.
We'll have some extra content for you about Philip Schuyler and Albany on our website. That's at nynow.org. And follow us on social media at nynow_PBS. Until then, thanks for watching this week's New York Now. Have a great week and be well.